Hello, this is Jay Nemro, and you're listening to The Life Autistic. This is episode 598. Hang on. Let me get things situated here. All right. I've been invited to serve on a panel. And, this is from some old friends. Like I said in the last podcast, maybe the one just before that, about home economics and how I love home economics. Well, since I went and visited my friend, mentor, professor, Dr. Merlene Olmsted, she's getting the state meeting of the Professional Organization of Home Economists pulled together, and she invited me to speak on a panel. It's talking about mending families, and I spent some time putting together a bio for her to put in the program, so you know people know who people are, and anyway, so when I was doing all that and pulling these things together, I started thinking a bit about what I think about this. In the past, I have been a professional do-gooder, which I don't particularly use as something that's particularly complimentary. Professional do-gooders are people hired by an organization, an institution, to do nice things. I always worked for the government when I was doing that, either under contract or as an employee. And I would always come, after a time, I would always end up just kind of questioning the whole thing. What I was doing, whether it was really being helpful. And I would find myself, I would find my conscience pricked when I would do these things, just because it just would. I'm not trying to say that they're bad people. I'm not trying to say that the things that are being done shouldn't be done. I'm not going to that level. You know, I'm not saying that people need to get fired. I'm not saying that society shouldn't try to address some of these issues. I just had a personal problem with it, so I'm not the right person to do those jobs, and therefore right now I'm not. I'm not a professional do-gooder now. I work for the state, but I'm more of an infrastructure person. You know, I help, I don't know if I provide tools. I don't provide tools, but I keep tools running for people who are professional do-gooders, or professional educators, actually, and researchers, things like that. Anyway, so, regardless, I've gotten out of the field of being a professional do-gooder just for my own conscience. I'm not asking anybody else to do it. And I think I'll talk about some of the reasons why, because I was pondering this earlier this morning, and it came into full flower during power hour. That's when I'm supposed to be reading my scriptures and saying my prayers. And I do get scriptures read, and I do get prayers said. But it's also where the best thoughts come, and it's where I can actually share them with Lisa, because at other times she's tired, she doesn't want to be met, she doesn't want to be bothered. I understand. Got a hard enough life. Anyway, so let me get right to it. I actually made notes. I that was one of the whole purposes of doing the Life Autistic, and that's one of the that was going to be one of the ostensible reasons why it was different from quasi-intifatigable Zenilef. Just my recordings. When I went to do a podcast, it was supposed to be because I was going to be a little bit prepared, at least have something in mind. And sometimes I even have notes. This is one of those times when I have notes. I'm doing so good today. So anyway, so let me turn my thing on here. I originally called this organizational thinking, but I think that's wrong. I think it should be called institutional thinking, even though I find most organizations end up behaving very institutionally. And but that's only because that's kind of where nature and the devil take it, you know, is turning these things into institutions. And my whole attitude is you got to put people before institutions. You know? There's a lot of things that that feed into this. Like I've said before, I'm always trying to get down very deep, you know. If I have a problem with something, I want to know if there's a deeper issue at work. And this is a pretty deep issue, institutional thinking. It pervades almost everything that we do in modern society. Modern society is institutional. We have institutions. They are the most important things. Supporting and propagating our quote-unquote institutions becomes the most important thing. You know, when people talk about America, what they're typically talking about are the institutions that we have here. And perpetuating that, mostly it starts with government, but it also starts with schools and hospitals and things like that. When you really get down to things, when people, even when you talk about the American dream, for instance, you're actually talking about protecting institutions. Like, you know, people try to do a gelatinous thing, but it's really other things. You know, people talk about, well, it's about the whole thing about home ownership. You know, and it really has more to do with preserving the institutions that are created to, well, first it was created to service home ownership, now the thing that rules home ownership. I was just, I don't know if I was listening or reading something that talked about how I was listening. The Jimmy Doan Show, Jimmy Doan, and kind of an on-again, off-again type radio, I guess it's a radio show, but when you look at the recordings that they put out, they're really infrequent. Like, this guy only has a radio show maybe once a month, or once every 2 weeks or something, and it's really interesting, but they were bringing up the fact that home ownership is down. There's fewer homeowners now in the United States than there's ever been. In those horrible days in the early part of the 20th century, the latter part of the 19th, late 1800s, early 1900s, for those of you who don't know how centuries work, we were a nation of people who owned stuff, probably because owning something wasn't that big of a deal back then. You know, having your own place was something that commonly happened when you were not even 20 yet. you would have a piece of land. Buying a piece of property and putting a house on it was something of a 2 or 3 year project when you were young. That was one of the first things that you did to indicate that you were an adult. You know, people considered you an adult when you had your own piece of land and you had at least some place to sleep on it. You know, it could have been a log cabin, it could have been something along those lines. Or it might have been something that was just kind of put together on the spur of the moment, knowing that you were going to get something better as time went by. You're going to build something better, you know, and that was what home or land ownership represented. That's what it was these things. I love how people are standing in the middle of a road. It's really annoying. As if they own it. And, you know, you shouldn't have anything to do with it. I guess, and that's probably true. The access roads are probably just for people working on construction projects. On the interstate. I'm on the interstate, and I'm involved in this project. Oh, I'm glad I got off the interstate. The construction continues. They've torn up the road, and they're rebuilding it. Okay, well, there it is. Anyway, doesn't matter as long as I don't get hit. These things ended up being, these were real simple things back in the old days. You know, and you said, oh, nobody could afford that. And you go, you know what? Everybody ended up being able to afford it. Land was opening up. People could do it. This was back in the days of homesteading. You could homestead land. They would give it to you if you could improve it. If you could live on it. Now, some of it wasn't very pleasant land. You know, it wasn't the best. It wasn't like you were going to have the perfect thing that usually took years and years to acquire through many trades of land as you became more prosperous. That brings up another institution that says your kids should always have better than your parents did the second that you're not under your parents. Your parents are expected to provide you with beautiful things as quickly as possible. I'm not a big person on that. You know, the kind of thing like, you know, a parent is expected to put you through incredibly expensive college, you know, and that becomes a responsibility. And you know what? I've already told my kids I'm not going to do it. I think college is important, but I think it's so important that you need to handle it. It's one of the most important things that you just need to get to. Why are we doing 25 miles an hour in front of this guy? I have grown weary of it. Jeez. Anyway, so okay, let me get back to institutions real quick. When you talk about home ownership, of course, home ownership is a whole thing. It's supposed to be one of those things that you go into deep debt for, and you're going to be paying for that debt for the majority of your life. If you're mobile at all, and everybody is almost expected to be presently, you'll never pay off a house. You'll always be moving and trading around and trying to get a bigger house. And, you never end up paying for it. You'll die in debt with a house. It'll sell and that's it. And it'll pay off some banker somewhere who's made buku amounts of interest on you. See, and that's... Anyway, and so when we talk about American institutions, we're not talking about home ownership as being an institution. That's part of the American dream, I guess. But what the institutions are that we try so diligently to protect are the industries that have built up around making this stuff happen and profiting off of this stuff. Our whole banking industry, at least partially, the whole mortgage industry particularly, is based on profiting off of people's desire to be homeowners. And they do a fine job. There's plenty of people that make tons of money. I have friends that are real estate agents. That's part of that. Know people who are bankers, and most of their money is loaned out in mortgages, especially in smaller places. This is typical. Just the way it is. So, our whole lives are ringed about by institutions and laws sick to support those institutions. They aren't there to support you. They're there to support the institutions. And now, I don't want to be rude. Many laws have been put into place to try to regulate institutions so that they don't become punitive or mean or take advantage of people. But always done with the cooperation of the institution. You know, everybody always says, well, yeah, we're going to try to protect people, but not at the expense of the institution. The institution must thrive. You know, people, when you look at those kind of laws, and this kind of leads into my next idea, you have to understand that those, I guess you would call them consumer protection laws, it ends up being anti-consumer abuse laws. The kind of laws that were put into place to make sure a slave owner didn't kill their slaves. It's more akin to those than to anything else. I think it's important to look at it that way, because initially institutions were created to service the needs of people, usually to take advantage of the economics of scale. You know, people would get together in cooperatives and form corporations to accomplish things that it was difficult for people to do by themselves, things that didn't make a lot of sense to do by yourself. If you lived along a riverbank, it made lots of sense to create an organization, an institution, where everybody who was touched by that river was a part of that organization, and they could work together on those issues that they shared on that river. You know, trying to protect it, trying to keep it from getting polluted, punishing people who were damaging things for people further downstream, things like that. It made lots of sense for those things to become somewhat of an institution. You would create an organization, you make bylaws, and people became subject to them. You could do penalties for people who polluted the river, making it less useful for those downstream. So, and what happened, and that's how it was. the institution was a creation and a servant of those who created it. People. Weren't normal people. Well, over time, and this happens to every organization, happens to every institution, it takes on a life of its own. Especially when it gets to an age where the original founders lose interest in it, grow tired of it. If it's a profit-making venture, a person who's perfectly happy with the riches they got from it, and they've moved on for one reason or another, death, attrition, whatever. And this institution then kind of takes on a life of its own. Unless people are really stringent about why this was founded and what its purposes are, most institutions will morph into something that is almost a living, breathing thing on its own and wants to be what it wants to be. And what always happens is that servant that you created, that institution is created to serve you and your friends, or you and those who had something in common with you, ends up becoming your master. And you see it every single day. Now, there are some people who, although they know this, are flummoxed when they start to actually consider it. Let's say your town, for instance, or your city, or your village, or wherever you live, if you live within the confines of some sort of a municipality, you have to understand why that municipality was created. It was created to serve the needs of the people within it. And it was the servant of the people. That's, you know, especially in a democratic society, that was what it was. People got together, they made decisions that affected all of them collectively, and it was a servant of the people. Now, over time, people have gotten accustomed to the fact that the city is this big thing. It is your ruler. It sets up laws that you have to obey. You know, that you can soften that up by saying, "Hey, it's a democracy. If you don't like the way it is, you can change it." But as an institution gets more entrenched and gets bigger, it becomes more and more difficult for changes to be made. It gets more difficult to do anything to it, and that therein lies the slavery. Let me ask you how you feel toward, let's say, your city government. Do you feel like it is your servant, or do you feel like you are its servant? And I have to say, the large majority of people will say, "Oh, I am the servant of my local government." You know, they pass laws, interesting laws, and you know, I'm obliged to keep it, whether I really like it or not. So that's what happens, is when the servant becomes the master. And that's what's happened with so many of our institutions. You know, we are slaves to hundreds or thousands of institutions. Through contractual obligation, through governmental control, through any number of different methods, you are beholden to an institution. And separating yourself from that institution is nearly impossible. There's no way you can completely do it. You can avoid getting yourself into positions where you don't have where you don't have a lot of contracts on you, like for a mortgage, for things like that. Of course, you know, you have to have a place to stay. In our country, we're thick with laws that make it impossible for you to go to some piece of public land and live there, you know, put up a shack or live in a cardboard box with, you know, with just sprayed shellac on top for a roof so it'll stay dry during a rainstorm. We have rules that say you can't do that. And they're everywhere. They're everywhere. Let me tell you, I've looked. I've looked long and hard to find the cheapest way to be, and they've almost closed up all the possibilities. Almost all of them. To make sure that you don't live anywhere except in government-acceptable houses that are extremely expensive. So you're almost kind of sucked into this. And so when we talk about the American institutions, that gets to be kind of what I think about. You know, these are things that you have to do. If you come to America, and of course it's funny because when you see somebody from a different country that comes here, especially from quote-unquote third world countries, they're totally flummoxed. They don't have this problem in third world countries. There's still places where you can go. There's places where you can go where government is very, very light. Our government is incredibly heavy. It isn't as heavy as it is in some European countries, where government has just practically taken over almost every aspect of your life. There are places where government is very light, not because they don't have laws, but because they're lightly enforced, because they can't be. They don't have enough of an infrastructure to enforce everything. In the United States, we have lighter enforcement than some countries, but we have tons of laws and, you know, stuff like that. At least I'm in a place where there's light enforcement. We have a different mindset in the West, especially once you get out of cities. And mostly the attitude is we want to be left alone. And the police are, to a degree, respectful of that. To a degree. Except that, you know, there are federal laws, there are state laws written to accommodate people in big cities. And at any given moment, if you rub somebody the wrong way, those rules can all of a sudden be thrown on you. And so that's why you tend to be kind to your neighbors, not because they deserve kindness, but because if you don't, they'll stick some form of government on you. So you tend to just say, hey man, you know, if you'll leave me alone, I'll leave you alone, and we'll just all be happy people. And hopefully we won't care what each other's doing. And if we do, we'll talk about it. We'll try to take care of it amongst ourselves without getting government involved, because we know what government will do if they get involved. There's places where you can go where all the government is some official comes through every now and then, sets up a table. Everybody's supposed to line up. They pay their taxes. It's usually a poll tax, a head tax, because they don't have any real structures for taxing anything else particularly, because people won't comply with it. That's what happened in the United States, is we are incredibly compliant. And that kind of turns us into suckers. We are much better slaves than most third world people in third world countries are. Most people in third world countries don't obey the law. They don't even know what the laws are. Laws are something that get done in big cities where there's lots and lots of police officers and troops and people to enforce them. They don't even write laws meant for people in rural areas or, you know, out in the bush, whatever you want to call it. Because nobody out there even knows that law or chooses to respect it. And that's usually expected in a lot of places. It's funny that in the United States, we have enforcement mechanisms now, mostly given to us through technology, and make it happen. Anyway, you know, village in Africa, somebody comes, sets up a table, you pay your head tax, and then they fold up their table, take the money, and they leave. And they leave you in relative peace. Obscurity. You can go on about your life. You can basically do what you want to do your neighbors aren't going to get all huffy about. You can do whatever you like. And what a wonderful amount of freedom that is. That's a place where you can put up a house, you know. If the government permits it, see, you've become a slave to an institution called government. If a government permits it, you can even buy land, and it's usually not a huge thing. Now, I find it interesting in some countries, especially. I was looking at an island in the South Pacific. I'm always looking for places that I think would be a better place to live than where I'm living. And I consider places that nobody else would go to. Places that are so inhospitable. But the only problem is, society's there, too. They interject themselves. You must do this and you must do that, even here, because you're the protector of this big country. And it's like, oh, God, I hate that. There are some places I go to where they just didn't bother you, just leave you alone. Don't bother me. Anyway, so, haven't found it yet. This is not the world. That was once a reality in the world in a lot of places. There are places all over the place where you could go where people just didn't bother you. Too remote from society, too whatever. They may still be out there. But I can't get my wife to move to those places, so that just, there's the answer. I can't go to those places. Anyway, there was this little country in the South Pacific, little island country, and they just straight up stopped playing the little games. Their reality is this. The land belongs to the government, period. You make lease payments. You can lease it from the government. It's still the government. At any time, the government can choose to end that lease, and you have to go somewhere else. And you know, and that's the way it is. You can build a house on it, but it's a lease. If the government decides to take that money, then they take your house, too. It's an improvement on their land. It's kind of like it is here in the United States. But they don't go with the funny thing of saying that you own it. Because, honestly, and these guys said it readily, too. They said some countries, they were pointing at the United States and, you know, most of Europe as kind of a model. You know, those guys were kind of looking down their nose at the United States and Europe because they say, well, there's this kind of mock ownership. And it's true because even though you may have bought that land, if you don't pay your property taxes on it, they will sell your land right out from under you. They'll give it to somebody else. And you'll go through an expensive process trying to hang on to your land if they decide to sell off your land for back taxes. Or there becomes a lien on your property. And people will, you know, people will, people will, even though you bought your land, all of a sudden it's in some kind of weird legal status because you owe somebody for the taxes that they chose to pay. They're basically buying up debt. And they can set up something where, you know, you can continue to pay them for the back taxes. They can charge you interest, stuff like that. It could be a very lucrative business for somebody looking to to clean up on tax auctions. Anyway, so So all these things have been indicative of the fact that that these things that we put together to serve us, the whole point of government was to make life nicer and useful for people living with it. You know, people formed governments. You would think that somebody who owned everything forced governments on us and we're all beholden to it. It really isn't true. People themselves set these things up for their mutual protection and for their mutual welfare and support. Not that the government was supposed to support them, but that some things were needed. You wanted to have somebody to enforce laws. People were spending too much time that they needed to be putting toward things that they enjoyed more, you know, making a living, recreational time, whatever. People would hire a sheriff, and they would give the sheriff things to enforce, usually just protections. They would, you know, people would draw out a jurisdiction, and you would empower them inside their jurisdiction to check on strangers coming through, make sure that they weren't doing bad things. That was the beginnings of government. When you had some common need that needed to be addressed and you decided to get together as a group to address that need. You had a common well that everybody drew from. So you would come together and make decisions as a group regarding this well. Are we going to, you know, are we going to put something over it to protect it? Are we going to, you know, is somebody going to be charged and we'll put together a little bit of money? Everybody will make a payment to try and to have, so that when that well needs to be worked on, all wells need to be worked on a regular basis. You know, when it needs to be improved, when it needs to have the inside recased, all those other things. That there would be the money to be able to do it, and that became things like tax levies, or to do things like that. Now you can go back to the feudal idea of it. That's the really basic village idea of it. Kings and stuff like that grew up out of those things. It all of a sudden became necessary for you to have an administrator over these things. And you would pay that person. And those things would ultimately morph into kings because, you know, it's happening in the United States. There ends up being dynasties. You know, there is a man who was the mayor of our town for this many years. He's groomed his son to take over. Therefore, you know, it becomes his son's thing. And that's where you start having kings from. Of course, it was based first on who was the strongest. You know, the initial kings were, hey, you know, the strongest guy in town becomes king, and we honored him. And it wasn't just that, it wasn't some right. He took it, and people were afraid, and people did what he asked. Anyway, so I'm sorry. I had to go past somebody who was doing construction on a really minimal road. But, you know, it has to be done on occasion. I didn't really want to go into all that. Gracious. Let me review what I'm supposed to be talking about here. Yeah, the servant becomes the master. You know, and that's what ultimately happens. Kings came about because people felt the need to be protected. And kings take advantage of that. Right now, we're seeing it right now. 9/11 happened. People are afraid. People are scared to death about terrorists. So they have basically empowered a king. Our president is now much more king-like, to the point to where he doesn't really listen to anybody else. There is, you know, I'm sorry, I really do view what's happening in the United States as being so much more akin to what happened to the Roman Republic. Now, we don't often think about the Roman Republic. We think about it as the Roman Empire. And that's what we're becoming. We're becoming the American, the United States Empire. You know, people used to say that because we seem to be so expansive. We like going into other countries and making them client states, which is what we're doing in Iraq. Iraq is a client state of the United States. They ostensibly belong to us. Afghanistan, we tried to make them a client state. They didn't come along very well. We're still working on that. Every time we surge, it's because something isn't doing a good job being a client state. What's really interesting that's happened here, you know, and so people have gotten accustomed to that kind of imperialism. But now we actually have an emperor. If you haven't been listening to the news, now they don't talk about much on the news. I get my news from many sources, or at least information from many sources. Whether they're honest or not is anybody's guess. Of course, that's true of your mainstream news sources, too. They're not necessarily being honest either. They've just over time been allotted more trust. For what reason, nobody knows. Anyway, we give people, well, okay, there's been a lot of laws passed, there's been a lot of presidential, what do they call the things when the president just makes it? An executive order, along with a lot of executive privilege, so nobody ever really gets to see what's going on. All in the name of fighting the war against terrorism, and the biggest part of fighting the war against terrorism is keeping lots and lots of secrets. The more secrets you have, the better everything goes. And we're developing all these great secrets, things we're not supposed to know about, and things that kind of slip through. And our president has essentially become an emperor. In Roman times, of course, all during the Roman Empire, there was still a Senate. I mean, it was kind of a hangout for the rich and powerful, and, you know, and it was like being kind of a ministerial group for the emperor after a while. But when it was first set up, the emperor was simply the speaker of the house, you know. They didn't have the kind of governmental system we do, particularly, where you have two houses of Congress and you have a president and stuff like that. The president was meant to be kind of the high sheriff. You know, if you were to bring it down to a kind of level with, like, your local government, Congress would be compared to your city council. You know, these are people that are elected and do stuff like that. The president is, which is funny because most people think, oh, I think the analog of the president is the mayor. No, it's not. It has nothing to do with that. Well, to a degree, what the president was really envisioned kind of like was a sheriff. He was like the big sheriff of the country. He was in charge of the day-to-day management of what Congress told him to do. You know, there shall be a law that this, this, and this will be done. And then it was given to the president and the executive branch, which is under the president, to enforce those things or to do what Congress told them to do. Now, we're finding more and more that the executive branch operates independently. They come up with their own policies and procedures that, that really never were voted on or acted on by Congress. Of course, Congress and the president often act in concert when it seems to be in the best interest. Parties become a much bigger influence on that kind of thing. Parties will tend to twist their congressmen and their senators into going along with the president because that party is excited about the time when they'll be able to have the presidency in their camp and they'll be able to act on all this power. So Congress has been slowly, in a very interesting kind of underhanded way, giving a lot of power over to the president. And just kind of getting kind of lazy, fat and lazy, and sitting back and just kind of, you know, every once in a while they'll scream and they'll yell about something the president did. But, by and large, they're rather complicit to it. They don't care. No, it doesn't matter to them. Because, you know, if they had lots and lots of power as a president, chances are in a couple of years, their party will be in power with as the presidency. And they won that. You know, the only real difference between the Roman Empire, who was ruled by emperors, who could have been nuts, because all of a sudden it became it was a power thing. Whoever was the most powerful general ended up becoming emperor. And it wasn't because everybody was sweet and kind. It's because everybody else was afraid of him. You know, Julius Caesar was so powerful and so great and so beloved by people that the Roman Senate just basically handed over power to him. And said, you know, you can do whatever you want. You know, for a while after Julius Caesar, and everybody was called Caesar after him because they took his place as he was actually called the dictator. Now that doesn't have the same connotation then as it does now. Anyway, so first it was the strongest, then it became kind of a heredity thing. You know, that's where our kings came from, was the Roman emperor started to behave more like a hereditary thing. You know, you had an emperor, his son, his oldest son, his strongest son, or however the emperor decided to do the next person, became the next emperor. And that's where we got kings and things like that, was it originally came from those kinds of ideas. Not exclusively, but that's where it came from. And all these institutions that we have, they become our kings. They become our rulers. Even though we put them together to service us, if you don't keep a good handle, and I mean a good handle, because there are many people out there who love power, who love wielding power, and institutions, and having a ton of institutions, gives those people lots of opportunities to take charge of something. You know, and depending on the sort of person that is taking charge of things, then it really becomes what that institution becomes. You know, Now, plenty of institutions have been set up as kind of the brainchild of one person. Sometimes good people, sometimes bad people. I understand. I've worked for people that were kind of kings, personal kings, you know, and they didn't often give up their power. I might be that way. The only institution that I'm really no, I'm not, because the only institution that I have really ever had any interest in being involved with was my family. And my family, you know, I think Lisa and I do stuff jointly. I come up with all the crazy ideas, and she has all the veto power to say no. The reason why we live in Tucson Carey is because that's where Lisa wants to live right now. If at some point she wants to move, we can move. Of course, I'm always applying pressure toward trying to get to better circumstances. She doesn't feel my circumstances are better, so she doesn't want to go. She doesn't want to go downhill. And I think that's silly, because I think we're going downhill anyway. It's just trying to adjust for it. She wants to hold on desperately to what she has. And that's okay. It's her nest, you know. She's much more an American than I am. Let's be really honest. You know, she buys into all the stuff that America does. Of course, slowly over time, especially in what she's seeing, but also because of her association with me, the fact that I'm always talking all the time about the stuff that I think about, she's becoming less so, you know. It isn't about having the biggest house and having all of the trinkets of all these things, you know, having all of the trappings of being an American. Yeah, I have 5 cars. I have, you know, all my kids have TVs. We all have VCRs. We all spend our time pursuing our own pursuits because of stuff like that. And we, you know, I really don't, you know, it doesn't. That's not a big thing in my thing because I've thought about it, and it's really untenable after some time. And we're already finding where it's starting to have some serious cracks. It's starting to flaw. And, you know, our economy is falling apart, and that's one of the most important institutions of all. You must protect the economy at all costs. You know, now, many people profit off the economy, and the more people you can get that have a vested interest in the economy, the more important the economy is. Ask any economist. Of course, they want the economy to keep going, because if there's no economy, they tend to lose their jobs. So it's become the most important institution. Everything else serves it. If you thought school served you as a parent, it doesn't. Of course, many times parents get sucked into the whole, you know, economic mindset and saying, well, I need to send my kid to school because if I don't, they won't have that economic thing. You know, we all have to be a part of the economy because we all have to trade with each other. We all have to, we're all forced into participating in utilities. We all have to, you know, all of our laws are wrapped around trying to keep economic things going. So if you want to be a law-abiding citizen, you're stuck dealing with the economy. Even if somebody's taking advantage of the economy, which is what the rich and powerful do all the time, is take advantage of the economy. Little people can't really do that. Big people can. And it isn't just a question of understanding. It's a question of being able to hold those reins and nobody rips it out of your hand. That's what the power was. That's where kings came from, or people that were powerful to the point to where nobody came to rip the reins out of your hand. And, you know, they set up clubs, too. You know, there were princes. You had a big king. You would help support that king and keep him powerful. In exchange, he would make you one of the princes. He would come to your aid if your peasants rose up against you or something like that. Or, you know, if your neighboring prince wanted to take over your land because he thought you were incompetent, or he thought he could do it. It really wasn't a question of competence. That was what he may have said. But it was really, can I wrestle control from this other guy so I can have a bigger, you know, so I can be more powerful? Maybe he wants to be the big over king one day. You know, and you always had this stuff going on. It was always this constant scramble to keep that power that you had, and you normally needed to continually add to it, or else, you know, or else problems would come apart. But you would make deals, you know, you would make treaties that said that you wouldn't attack them if they wouldn't attack you. You know, and trade made that wonderful, too. I went all over the place with this institutional thing. I don't know what to tell anybody about avoiding institutions. I've been trying. I look around all the time to find ways to escape institutions. I have not found any legal way to do it. And I'm obliged by God to obey the laws, even the stupid ones, even the ones that are designed to enslave me, I must obey. You know, my job, unfortunately, is to be a good slave. And I don't do a very good job of it. I don't make a very good peasant. I don't make a very good serf. Which is, guess what I am? I'm not really a slave. I'm more of a serf. We are creating modern serfs all the time. And powerful people like it that way. Because serfs do what they're told. Because all you have to do is say, you know, I'm going to take away your livelihood, and all of a sudden, you know, oh, I'm not going to, you know, I'll do whatever the thing guy tells me, because he can destroy my life. He can destroy my livelihood. And that's powerful, heady stuff. And I guess what I'm saying is, do the most that you can to make it so that you're not beholden. You're beholden to as few institutions as you can be, including government. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, I'm not interested in anarchy. I'm not much of an anarchist. But I am a person who says I come from a religious tradition that says, teach them proper principles and let them govern themselves. And that kind of goes against organized government. You know, government doesn't like those kinds of ideas. People governing themselves is chaos to them. And we've got it. I look forward to the time when God makes something different. When God makes a different world. You know, when all the governments are destroyed, when all the bad people are burned, and there's only good people left. I look forward to that time. What a magical time that will be. Hope I see it. Hope I see it. Hope I get to live in it. Anyway, so if not, you know, that's life, and I look forward to a wonderful afterlife. This is Jay Nimro. You're listening to Quasi Indefatigable Zenilith. This has been episode number 598. Sorry, and institutions. May they all be kept under control. May they all be checked. And there you go. I'm sorry, I was about ready to bear my testimony. And I'm not gonna. This is Jay Nimro. Have a great day.